This is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and our visit with 96-year-old Patch Curtis, who still has his dog tag strung together with a blood-soaked shoelace from the day he earned his Purple Heart in the Philippines in 1945. We're going to get to that, but first, let's hear about his motivation. He spent his first couple years in uniform at various bases around the U.S., including the famous Santa Anita racetrack. His time there even turned him into an extra for a war movie starring Edward G. Robinson. But the real thing was raging thousands of miles away, and Patch had an important reason that he wanted to get over there and do something about it.
The compelling reason was this. When I was at the boarding house in October of 1941, after I got home from work, there was a message on my bed and said, call Willard Pearson in San Francisco at this number. He was a former neighbor, a next-door neighbor from that. Where the house I was born, Mr. and Mrs. Pearson, Willard, and his younger sister, Virginia. Virginia was a year older than I was. We were chums, so we kind of grew up more or less together. Anyway, I went over and saw Willard, and he and his wife were in a hotel room in San Francisco with their little son, Mike. They had been given a two-month vacation in the States from their job in the Philippines. They were working for the Itaogan Mine Corporation in Baguio, P.I., Philippine Island.
Right.
Baguio was up on the north end of Luzon. I went over and visited one night with them, and I went back the second visit with them. And Mr. and Mrs. Pearson were still in the Philippines, and Virginia had married a mining engineer from Canada, and he was also working in the same mine there. And Willard and his wife were going back. Well, they finally got their boat and went back. But that was October 1941. On December 8th, the Japanese picked them up and put them in prison camp, the whole family. So should I help if I can? Yes, I should.
So while you're in the Army and you're training these guys and all that, you're aware that your friends are prisoners in the Philippines.
That's right.
So your desire was to go to that part of the war and do what you could to set them free.
That's right.
And after a series of assignments at different bases across the United States, that opportunity to head to the Pacific finally materialized.
Was put on a 20,000-ton Victory model troop transport that had about 2,000 guys on it. We didn't know where we were going at that time, but we went out under the Golden Gate Bridge and so on. And 19 days later, we made landfall at Milne Bay, right on the southern tip of New Guinea. We were told that we were supposed to go up the coast to Oro Bay, and we were be unloaded there. And Oro Bay happened to be a replacement center for the Southwest Pacific at that time. So there were hundreds of us off at Oro Bay there. We spent our days there unloading ships with supplies and all that kind of stuff while we were waiting for assignment to whatever unit we would be assigned to. One of my tent mates was Roy Dunlap. Roy and I struck it off great because he'd been a target shooter back in Illinois, and he had trained as a gunsmith in one of the foremost gunsmith shops in the U.S. He later turned out to be a custom gunsmith and built custom guns down in Tucson, Arizona. His largest order were 30 special 6.5 guns for the Olympic shooting team. Roy and I both were assigned to the 1st Cavalry Division and were put on a ship and went up to Los Negros Island in the Admiralty Group. Roy was assigned on the initial landing group to go on up, and I was assigned to the group to stay on Los Negros and finish up. I didn't get to Leyte until November the 20th. They made the initial landing on Leyte October the 20th. I was assigned to the Troop B, 7th Cavalry. They had been in action, and they were in a replacement center, and I was one of the replacements that they got where they had lost from the action they'd been in. We were there for 5 days getting acquainted with my new squad, and were put on trucks and trucks from Natunga, about center on the northern end of Leyte, and we were transported across to the northwest corner of Leyte at a place called Carragera. We were offloaded the trucks on the beach at Carragera. That's where we formed up and headed up the Sugud Road across a place named Limon, up on the top of the mountain, heading south toward Ormoc, where the main body, the Japanese, were. But in the meantime, the Japanese were in control of all of this road net off and on all the way south of Carragera. At the time we offloaded, there was a battery of 455 long toms firing across the island from Carragera Beach down to Ormoc, which was about 20-some miles. These 155-millimeter shells at Limon, we were right under the path of those bullets going over. Every time a salvo of four shells would go across, it would sound like a freight train going through the air over you. We had a tragic result there. These shells are 6 inches in diameter and they weigh 90 pounds. And the driving band to seal the gas as they go through the barrel is copper alloy that's driven into a dovetail around the base of the shell. Once in a great while, one of those will split and tear off due to the centrifugal rotation of the shell. It's thrown off at rather high speed. We had ringed the top of the road at this place named Limon, and we were all laying down out of breath, catching our breath and so on. And one of these salvos went over, and one of the guys about four rows over, I heard a big, ugh! And looked over to see what happened. One of these rotating bands had came off and come down and cut him in two right to the spine.
Mm.
So that was our first close scrape of combat. But that afternoon we went on down our slope, and we had a firefight that afternoon down at the creek. We didn't suffer any casualties there, but we scored a few. We camped there, and that was the last real fresh water that we saw for the next 5 days. And the next morning, my squad was appointed point, and we went up a muddy trail. I could still see the footprints with water running back into it, for somebody was going up this muddy trail ahead of us. So I sent word back that we were right on the Japanese trail. Sure enough, about 15 or 20 minutes later, a guy pops out from behind the bush. I started delivering off shots with my M1 and stepped over to the left. My BAR man let go at him, and he was only less than the distance between me and Cindy there.
10 feet or so, less.
And we got out of that one okay, but he had turned out to be the equivalent of a major in rank, and he had a tremendous flag with hundreds and hundreds of signatures on it, and I got that flag. Next memorable thing was the Christmas morning, the dawn nice and clear with a lot of sparkling water drops that had rained during the night, and the sun as it came up on those just made every little glot of water look like a gleaming diamond, and the air was fresh and so on. But we missed our airdrop. There wasn't any food that day. All we had to eat that day was what we had in our pack, and all I had in my pack was one tropical chocolate bar.
Mm-hmm. I gotta ask you though, I mean, you've had a lot of years since then. You're talking about 1944. We're going to be coming up on Christmas 2017 before long. Has there been a Christmas since then where you didn't think about being back there in the Philippines on that Christmas morning with nothing to eat?
Never.
Gave you some perspective, huh?
Sure does.
And in a moment like that, do you think of family back home? Do you wonder if you're ever going to see them again?
Not really. You're so preoccupied with what you're confronted with right then, you hardly have a chance for daydreaming.
Every guy gives me a different response. Some people say, hey, I thought I was invincible. It was going to happen to everybody else and not me. Other guys say, I just knew at some point, you know, it was going to be me. Did you have a feeling one way or the other? I mean, were you scared? Were you concerned that you weren't going to get out of this?
Every time you're on the point, you're scared. Your adrenaline is pumping. You're scared. You're apprehensive. Is it now or...
Sure. There's nobody in front of you.
Right.
It's you and the enemy.
That's me and it.
And that was a familiar position for you? Something that you were doing regularly?
Pretty often, because they traded this point thing equal among the squad.
And you have an x-ray sitting right here that I'm going to make sure we get a picture of and put at hometownheroesradio.com. This is a recent x-ray, and it shows some souvenirs that you're still carrying all these years later. But before you got hit, before you were wounded, were there some other moments that you look back on now and say, hey, that was pretty close too?
Well, almost every one of those situations you get into, you say, got through that one. One of the other peculiar things is that me or him, Shorty Barrett comes to mind. Shorty Barrett was a fellow squad leader. The platoon sergeant was talking to us, giving us a kind of assignments and so on. And Shorty got hit in the chest, and he went down.
How far away was he from you when that happened?
Well, 3 feet.
If they could hit him, they easily could have hit you.
Oh, easy, sure. Any one of us could have got it. But the peculiar thing about it is, after we got up on Luzon several months later, and Shorty got through his chest wound and came back, we were called together for the same reason, the same way. And who got hit? Shorty.
Twice. Did he survive that one too?
I don't know. I never heard. We never heard anything from him that time.
And Luzon is where you received your wounds.
Yeah. This is really the one dramatic wartime scene that you could ever see went off on the day that I got wounded. I was taken out on March 8, 1945. On the 6th, these big B-24 bombers began. We were all lined up down on a road at the foot of the mountains. The Yamashita line was the objective, and the town we wanted to get was Antipolo. On the 6th, the B-24s would come over in strings of three and drop 500 and 1,000-pound bombs on Antipolo and the Japanese fortifications that they could identify in that area. They came over a good part of the 6th and a good part of the 7th, off and on all day long, dropping these bombs. And we were a good 3-4 miles from there. But every time one of those 1,000-pound bombs would go off, your helmet would go like this on your head.
Rattle around a little.
4 or 5 miles away. Oof. Anyway, that went on. And then on the morning of the 8th, we were given instructions that there were going to be a 3-division push on Antipolo starting at 8 o'clock on March the 8th. No one had watches anymore because in the tropics and everything, watches and cameras just didn't, they just disappeared.
Mm-hmm.
They just, the bands had rot off, so hardly anyone knew what time it was. But the 6th Division on the north, the 1st Cavalry Division in the center, and the 41st Division on the right. And if they're all in full strength, that would be 45,000 men. But to give you an idea, my squad was down 2 men. There was only 6 or 7 of us where there should have been 9. That was permitted all 3 of the division because we'd all been in combat for a couple of months and we had lost a lot of people for this reason and for that.
Sure.
Mostly illness and just being completely worn out. But the first thing that happened, an A-20A attack plane with a smoke started and they just laid a smoke screen 10 miles across the face of that mountain. They had 4.2 chemical mortars set up in intervals all down through that 10-mile section firing red smoke shells. And as these red shells would go up, they were spaced apart. Each unit was supposed to stay in that line that was delineated by these smoke lines. So when they made the blackout, these red lines started up, and we were given the order to go. So we went ahead. Now, our particular assignment that day was to take a artillery observation unit from a 155-millimeter howitzer battery and place them on their optimum observation point. We were supposed to escort them up and get them put down on the place where they were supposed to direct the fire from their battery. I had been on patrol in that day before and was most familiar with the area that they wanted to go traverse, so I was appointed point. So we started out at 8 o'clock up to the smoke screen after the massive artillery barrage went off ahead of us, and as we went up, the ground was filled with craters 12 to 18 inches deep. Ground looked like it had just been plowed with these shells, but we went on up, and when I say up, it was the base of a mountain, and it, as you went further up, it got steeper and steeper and steeper.
Sure.
We were pretty successful and didn't receive too much resistance, and only a couple of firefights on the way up. Till about 11 o'clock, we got up down a particular area. We ran into some resistance. The unit commander decided the best way to subdue the Japanese was we had a bazooka section that would fire bazooka shells, a 60-millimeter mortar section, and so they fired up all the bazooka shells. The Japs still continued to fire back at us. All of the mortar shells got used up trying to knock them out, so there weren't any more mortar shells available. So finally, platoon sergeant said to me, "Curtis, take your squad down and see if you can knock them out with grenades."
And those would prove to be very fateful orders, as we'll understand fully when we come back. We're going to hear how severely Mr. Curtis was wounded on March 8, 1945, and what it took to save his life. If you'd like to see a video of Mr. Curtis explaining his injuries, you can find that at hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page. And we'll be right back after this.